This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with returning guest, Peter Schuck. Peter is the author of the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. And Peter, in a prior segment, we talked about some of the successes of government in your view. Let's, in this segment, start by talking about some examples of some failures.
Well, they're really too there are too many to discuss in the next couple of days. But
I should mention we only have about 12 minutes.
So here, okay. Let me get at that by mentioning some different problems, some structural problems, and then give examples of those. So we have a very unique political culture. Our political and constitutional DNA are such that it's very hard for the government to take on ambitious agendas and carry them out effectively. Now, certain elements of that that DNA are the constitutionalism embedded in our society, the restrictions on government, as well as other aspects of the Constitution. And then we're a very decentralized society. And so the federal government really can't control, and this is a good thing, I think, can't really control very much of what is necessary to make a difference at the local level. There's just too much diversity in our society for it to be able to manage with uniform rules. And then we have a constitutional commitment to individual rights, which makes it very hard for the government to implement these ambitious programs, because the courts are there to protect individual rights and is constantly going to confound the government's plans. And then we have interest group pluralism, which means that there's just a vast, much larger than any other society, a vast number of interests that insist on being heard and influencing policy, and some are more powerful than others. But it's not just a question of money; it's also a question of their ability to manipulate the media, their ability to make good arguments, and lots of other reasons. But it makes for an extremely complex system, and so. There are lots of constraints of this sort on government programs. So you know, give some examples. Take the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade legislation that the government is trying to adopt, and Congress has actually authorized the president to do this. But the number of interests that are negotiating and insisting on protecting their financial interests are such that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to negotiate a deal with other countries. Another example of government failure resulting from the same problem of interest groups being able to exploit the constitutional system to make sure that nothing gets done to change their situation is subsidies to agriculture, which are bloated, no longer speak to an industry that exists in anywhere near the form that it did when these programs were adopted back in the 30s. So the sugar industry today, for example, enjoys enormous subsidies, which increase the costs of all sorts of food manufacturers and the cost to consumers. And it serves the interests of a very, very small number of firms who have been able to prevent any change to this policy. Lots of examples of that sort of thing.
Let me just focus on a couple of these things, Peter, if I could. You mentioned subsidies to agriculture, and it just strikes me as you were talking that some of these subsidies were actually put in place in the 30s, and they still exist. Seems to me that whenever a government does something or creates a program, it's very difficult to get a program eliminated. It seems like new programs are just stacked upon old, ineffective programs. What's your take?
I think that's very, very true. And one of the pleas in my book is for much greater analysis of the effectiveness of programs and who gains and who loses from these programs. So I have a whole chapter on the analysis of cost effectiveness. And a very important finding that I discuss in the book is that the vast majority, some experts have estimated 99% of the money that we spend, the federal government spends each year, has absolutely no evidence of effectiveness to support it. And that comes from, that estimate comes from the head of the Obama budget office, Peter Orszag, and the top budget official in the George W. Bush administration. So this is a bipartisan problem. Politicians create these programs, but they don't want to justify them in any kind of hard-nosed analytical terms before the program's created, and then after it's created, they just want to go on to something else and pretend that these programs are working. And in a vast number of cases, they're not.
So, Peter, you just mentioned there seems to be consensus on both sides of the aisle that a lot of government spending is ineffective, if not 99%. I think we could say the vast, vast majority and be safe. So if there is this consensus...
Well, the 99% figure is that we don't have any evidence. We've never studied to see it.
Gotcha.
I don't know if 99% is ineffective, but 99% of the programs are not assessed in terms of their effectiveness.
Thank you for that clarification. If there is consensus, if there is agreement that a lot of government spending is ineffective or needs to be studied, why are we not moving ahead to try to resolve some of this ineffectiveness? What's keeping it from getting done?
Well, one of the things is that costs that are imposed by ineffective programs are benefits to somebody. Somebody gains from them, and so they fight hard to maintain these advantages, even though they're very costly to the rest of us. A lot of the tax, I discuss this, the tax expenditure programs are highly advantageous to upper middle class and upper class people, and not to to middle lower working class people, who bear most of the burdens of those tax expenditures because they have to pay higher taxes in order to finance them. That's one kind of example of a social cost being of great benefit to a relatively small number of people. A second thing is that these programs often sound good, and we want to believe that they're effective, but they turn out not to be. So Head Start's a very good example of this. Everybody wants Head Start to succeed. It costs it's a hugely expensive program at this point after 50 years, we all believe in helping kids learn, and especially if they come from disadvantaged backgrounds. But study after study shows that these programs, that the Head Start program does not work, and that by the third grade, any advantages that Head Start students have over those who didn't enter the program, controlling for every other variable, have vanished. It's a really hard problem, but because the program speaks to our deepest hopes for improving the lot of disadvantaged kids, we adopt the program and then don't change it much.
Peter, let me go back in the time we have left. You had mentioned that some of these programs benefit a fairly small group of people. That makes me think of something you brought up earlier, that one of the issues is interest group pluralism. How big a problem are special interest groups in fixing these issues?
Well, it's extremely complicated because what I'm calling special interest groups or interest group pluralism is actually a very good thing from many perspectives. The results can be very perverse, but after all, what it is that people seeking representation of their interests, of what they hope to accomplish, and the values that they have. So, you know, in a democracy, they deserve to be heard. The problem is that some groups have superior advantages politically. And again, I emphasize money is only one of the advantages that they may have. There are many other groups that are relatively poorly funded that have a lot of influence because of some other thing that they have, such as a very mediagenic sponsor or a name like Kennedy or Bush behind them. And so interest group activity is absolutely essential in a democracy, but one would hope that the politicians who have to listen to all their claims, the interest group claims and pressures, would deliberate and would find better ways of harmonizing the conflicting interests in a very complex society. It's a hard job. Being a politician is an extremely hard job. But they could certainly do a better job than they do now. And I explained a variety of reasons why that is and how it could be better.
Well, Peter, we've got about a minute and a half left. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that we're entering another election cycle here. Do you see anything on the horizon with a candidate, with the American mood, that would signal we might be seeing a change that would bring us closer to solutions on some of these issues?
I wish I could, but I don't. And I am a very optimistic person. I'm very bullish on the United States. I think this is the greatest system in the world, as despite its many, many flaws. But the political situation in the country is sharply divided, and we should recall that it's always been sharply divided. This is not new. Some of the impediments to compromise are greater today than they were before. The good news is that the American public seems to be fed up and is demanding change, but only in a fairly inarticulate way. And so candidates can interpret those complaints in many different ways. So I don't see a great deal of progress in the future. What matters most in American society, I think, is how the economy works. And in one sense, this political polarization makes it harder for the government to mess with the economy. And I think, by and large, that's a good thing. So if our economy works well and our civil society, which consists of all the organizations that do great things in our society, churches and social organizations and so forth, then I think if they continue to do that, I think we'll be in pretty good shape, notwithstanding the government. The trick is to keep the government from doing a lot of harm, and I think the American public is eager to do that.
We're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Peter Schuck. His book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better, coming out in paperback this month on Amazon. Peter, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Dennis.
This week on Everything Financial Radio, we've been talking about the similarities between policy response or government actions taken today versus the 1930s. And we talked about the fact previously on Everything Financial Radio that we are in, we believe, an economic winter season. And an economic winter season follows an economic autumn season. And while there are a lot of characteristics of these that I talked about previously, just to frame the conversation in this segment, let me once again briefly discuss those. In an economic autumn season, debt accumulates to the point that the system cannot handle any more debt. Debt in the system has reached its capacity. In a winter economic season, debt is purged from the system, which has a number of unpleasant economic consequences, deflation being one of them, and that typically means fewer jobs, lower trade, lower pay for those that have jobs, and stocks decline. Now, policy response, as we discussed, can often make matters worse. Now, we talked about in the segment that preceded this that in the 1930s, at the beginning of the Depression, the economy was tanking, and in an effort to try to fix the tanking economy, the government put tariffs in place on imported goods. That's basically a tax on imports. The idea being that if you make foreign goods more expensive, the goods that you manufacture domestically in your own country now become more attractive. Well, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of June of 1930 was put in place, and as the bill was being considered, a number of special interest groups got involved with Congress, not unlike what we see today. And by the time the legislation passed, the bill raised tariffs not only on agricultural products, which was the initial intent, but on all products in all sectors of the economy. Now, this did not help end the Great Depression. In fact, in my view, it caused more suffering because we saw countries affected by these tariffs retaliate. Now, without going through all the blow-by-blow descriptions of all these efforts at retaliation, the bottom line is U.S. imports from Europe declined from a 1929 high of about $1.3 billion to just $390 million in 1932. So in 3 years, let's just say there was almost a 70% decline in U.S. imports from Europe. And U.S. exports fell by about the same margin from $2.3 billion to $784 million over the same time frame. So that's almost a 70% decline in world trade during that time frame. That is significant. So there were some unintended consequences, things that were policy responses that were implemented that made things worse. Now, are we beginning to see a repeat today of the same mistake? I believe that we are. There was an article in USA Today this past week that talked about the fact that China this past week took steps to devalue its currency. I'll give you just a bit from the article. Stocks tumbled and oil hit a six-year low Tuesday after China unexpectedly reduced the value of its currency in an effort to provide a boost to its lagging economy by making goods more affordable to foreign buyers. China reported that its exports fell more than 8% in July. While a weaker yuan, which is the Chinese unit of currency, makes Chinese exporters' products more affordable abroad, it makes U.S. goods exported to China more expensive. That could crimp sales and profits of U.S. companies that do business in China. In short, a weaker yuan makes U.S. products less competitive in China. If the yuan is weaker, it makes Chinese goods that are sold in the United States more attractive. It turns them into a really good deal, and it makes it really tough for the United States exporters that sell goods in China to compete because the dollar is so much stronger than the yuan, the Chinese currency. Now, there's a debate going on in Wall Street saying that is the move by China seen as a sign that the government is concerned about weak growth, and what will that mean when the Federal Reserve looks at raising interest rates, which they're widely expected to do? Now, let me point out that the last two times the Federal Reserve or the FOMC has met, we have predicted they would not raise interest rates. I will again go on record as saying that I don't believe they will raise interest rates again either. And if they do, it will be a quarter point increase, I believe, which is really more symbolic than it is anything else. Now, ultimately, I believe that what's going on worldwide is the beginning of what we saw in the 1930s. We saw tariffs being slapped on imported goods by a number of countries. The result was plunging trade. We're not seeing tariffs this time, but we're seeing currencies being devalued. Now, the Chinese government is trying to make their exports more attractive. Now, where is the Chinese economy? Well, there was an article published by CBC, CBC News, that talked about the fact that the Chinese economy has been underperforming. And Lauren Brand, who's a professor at the University of Toronto's Department of Economics, said that this is a normal course of action. This is that seen in most weak economies. Their exchange rate adjusts, and it provides a margin with which they can try to help the economy recover. China's economic growth fell to 7.4% in 2014. That's a drop off from double-digit growth they were experiencing prior to that. The country's manufacturers are seeing their fourth year of price deflation. That is a symptom of debt excesses. Let me just go on record as saying that this will not happen, and in reality, China is kind of coming late to this currency devaluation game, and we expected that they would. Japan began devaluing its yen a couple years ago using quantitative easing similar to what the United States has used. Britain and the European Central Bank have also deployed monetary policies as recently as this spring, aimed at bringing down the value of the pound and the euro as well. So worldwide, we see countries trying to win the export game by devaluing currencies, similar to the way in the 1930s that countries attempted to win it by slapping tariffs or taxes on imported goods. The result, I believe, will be the same unintended consequences that we saw in the 30s. Trade will fall off, stocks will fall, and the economy will suffer. I would invite you to visit the website investingapproach.com. The website is investingapproach.com. There you can order a copy of our Investor's Discovery Kit that contains a number of different resources to help you kind of figure out how your nest egg might fit in and how it might be affected by what's going on in the world economy. So again, the website is investingapproach.com.